They wanted more. Falcon chuckled inwardly. They're just children, he thought. Just as quickly, he chided himself for his naivety. Not in this context. Today they are a political statement. It was sad, but true. He shook his head, hoping he would be able to shield them from such undertones. Ko was defeated in the next fight, barely. The boys had been evenly matched, and if not for the smaller boy's superior speed, it might have turned out differently. You fought bravely, Falcon said as the boy walked up. You should be proud.
I am, Ko said with a thin smile. But my father will not be satisfied.
Falcon's temper flared as he watched the boy's father scold him. He began play-acting the end of the fight, showing the boy what he should have done, how he could have fought better. There was a time for learning from one's errors, Falcon knew, but it wasn't now. Now the boy should be congratulated on how far he'd come in the tournament. Then, once the dust had settled, he could be taught. Falcon planned to do just that, if he still had a job on the morrow. Next up was Ava and another student of Fenru. As was typical of such a match-up, the contest was a flurry of action, each competitor wasting no time in going on the attack, landing several heavy blows that left them both bloodied, whipping the crowd into a frenzy.
Come on, Falcon thought as they circled, both breathing heavily.
The thought came from the knowledge only a master could have of his student, that she was faking it. Never had he seen Ava winded, for she was as well conditioned as any in his group. On cue, she went on the attack again, well before the boy was ready. A student of Fen Lu could likely have blocked the high kick, and a practitioner of Fen Sir might have danced lithely out of reach, but this boy was neither, attempting, too late, to launch a high attack of his own. While Ava's foot thudded heavily against his jaw, his own kick glanced harmlessly off her shoulder. She spun with the impact, sweeping her opposite leg along the ground and taking out his legs from behind. He tumbled backwards, and she fell upon him, her legs pinched around his throat. Unable to speak, he tapped the ground three times in submission, and Ava released him. Falcon's students, along with a hardy portion of the crowd, erupted in a cheer. By their very nature, those who would be otherwise neutral tended to drift toward Fen Ru because of the action-packed nature of the art. Falcon hugged Ava as the boys patted her back. She had represented them all, and done so well.
Let them take my job after this, Falcon thought.
Having a student reach the finale was no easy feat. He glanced up to find Shanti watching him. There was something in her eyes that gave him pause. He'd seen that look before, many years ago. He'd wanted to see that look for so long it took his very breath away. But then he blinked and it was gone, replaced by a half-smile and a nod of congratulations.
I imagined it, Falcon thought, feeling foolish. It was just like him to romanticize everything. Not everything is one of your stories.
He nodded back, and then returned his focus to Ava, who would have a brief rest before taking on Shanti's final student.
Winning or losing, he said, matters not.
Master?
Ava said, scrunching her face into a frown. She was full Phoenician, her mother a delegate from Gem City and her father a nut farmer. Her hair was as black as jet, and yet her eyes were darker and full of intensity.
You think I don't know that? You have taught us much all year. I will fight with honour, and let the gods decide if it is enough.
Although everything the girl said was true, Falcon was taken aback. For some reason he never believed his words penetrated his students' young minds. Perhaps it was because he could never seem to get through to Shanti. Still, hearing the pure, unabashed honesty coming from Ava, his champion now, was like a light in a storm.
Thank you, he said. Now enjoy the moment and do us proud.
I will.
She stepped into the circle. If Ava was the power and strength of thunder and lightning, Shanti's warrior was the quiet, graceful might of the wind. As such, neither could gain an advantage. Each time Ava attempted a direct assault, her opponent would find a way to escape, acrobatically in many cases. And when the girl tried to slip past Ava's lethal hands and feet, Ava would dive roughly away, willing to accept the minor scrapes and bruises to avoid taking a blow. The crowd was growing restless, the sun beating down on the spectacle. After an hour, Falcon could see that Ava was finally growing weary. Her opponent wasn't much better off, her chest heaving, her face dripping sweat. One of them would make a mistake eventually, sooner rather than later, given their exhaustion. But they never had the chance. At first, the scream didn't register in Falcon's brain. Though it was loud and piercing, he'd grown used to the raucous crowd. But this was different, he finally realized, frowning, slowly turning to try to discern the origin. The scream was repeated, and everything froze for one moment as a hushed silence fell over the crowd. A body fell, flung over a balustrade from high above the courtyard. The body bounced off the edge of one of the steps, tumbling the rest of the way in a jarring manner that made it look less human than inanimate object. The crowd at the base of the staircase scattered, the corpse landing with a final thud, unseeing eyes staring directly into the sun.
By the gods! Falcon thought,
trying to understand what had happened, still not comprehending what his subconscious had realized the moment the woman fell. For her cheeks were marked with black tears, which could only mean one thing. This was no accident. The moment passed, sucking away the silence in a cacophony of screams, which seemed to arise all around. More bodies fell from above, while men wielding swords rushed down all seven of the palace staircases that led to the courtyard. Falcon was weaponless, as were his students, as was everyone at this event. Sonica's tears had been thorough in their search at the entrance gates. As Falcon shepherded his students behind him, he watched in horror as the men killed without mercy or bias, striking down men, women, and children with ruthless focus. If chaos and murder were their objective, they had already succeeded on both counts. Falcon's one and only objective was to protect the students he'd been charged with teaching, so his stomach dropped to his feet when he saw Ava trying to fight through the stampeding throng to get to him. Just behind her was a large man swinging an axe, cutting down people as easily as hacking through a field of weeds. Falcon sprang forward, shoving several people aside in the process, watching as Ava sensed the danger behind her, turning just in the nick of time, ducking under a swipe of the man's axe, instinctively lashing out with a foot, connecting solidly with his knee, a blow that would have crippled a smaller man. As it was, he absorbed the impact with the barest of cringes before grabbing her by the throat and lifting her into the air, drawing his axe back for a life-ending blow. Falcon launched himself in front of her, clutching the shaft of the axe and shoving it harmlessly down, where it sparked as it struck the stonework. The transition from proud master to soldier occurred far swifter than Falcon could have ever imagined. Yes, he'd often had nightmares from the fall of all things, but he'd never allowed any of it to spill into real life. He counted himself lucky in that regard, as many of the Phoenicians who had fought and survived on that day had been less fortunate, the memories of battle dragging them slowly down into madness. In less than the time it took his foe to blink, he'd disarmed him and driven his own weapon deep into his chest. The man gasped, a look of surprise flashing across his expression, and then he fell, blood bubbling from his lips.
"Go!"
Falcon shouted to Ava, and she didn't need to be told twice, scurrying away to find her fellow trainees. The nature of the crowd was slowly changing. Those who fled, the parents and friends of the students, separated from those who stepped forward, toward danger rather than away. Falcon felt a thrill rush through him as he realized the composition of defenders. Black tears and masters of the martial arts, all of them. The attackers, who were clearly the rebels who'd been wreaking havoc across the realm, gathered before them might have been masters of one art or another, but they were the invaders. The dead lay all around their feet. Falcon saw the man who had threatened him lying in a pool of blood. Despite their differences, he felt sad.
Why must differences always end in violence?
Sonic of Aid stepped up beside Falcon. He glanced at her, and she said,
"For old time's sake?"
Something about the lightness of her comment in the midst of such darkness gave him strength.
"Yes," he agreed.
On his opposite side, Shanti appeared. He had the urge to order her back to safety, but he would not do her such a disservice. He was no longer the Emperor, hadn't been for many years, and anyway she was more capable than he in so many ways, combat included.
"Sorry I missed the last battle," she said. "Mind if I join this one?"
Sonica snorted out a laugh. Falcon said,
"First one to kill 10 is the winner."
"Only 10, Falk," Shanti said,
and he couldn't help but to love the familiarity between them. Looks like you'll come in last place. The men pressed forward now, so he didn't have time for a retort, gripping the handle of the axe he'd stolen, wishing his ankles and wrists were strapped with blades. The attackers charged, and soon the clash of steel on steel filled the air, many of the combatants springing lithely off hands and feet, twisting and turning acrobatically through the air. Falcon slid beneath one such aerial attack, his foe's blade slashing at his throat but missing wildly. Falcon turned and swung at the man's legs as he landed, cutting them out from under him. He went down with a cry, dropping his own weapon. Falcon had the awareness to whip back around as another attacker came from the back. A blade slashed against the shaft of the axe as he brought it up to defend himself. There was a vicious crack, but the shaft held strong enough to save his life. Still, it was broken beyond further use, so he flung it down. Instead of fleeing, like his opponent might expect, he threw himself forward recklessly, punching him sharply in the face thrice in short succession, before wrenching the sword from his grip. A single slash, and the man died. Falcon spun, seeking out his next enemy, but found most of them were down already. Several of the defenders had fallen too, but not Sonica, who was finishing off the last of the rebels, and not Shanti, who drew her blade out of the chest of a man, tossing it aside with an expression akin to disgust. Falcon exhaled slowly, taking in the carnage around him. Rebels and innocents alike were scattered across the courtyard, and he couldn't help but remember that day all those years ago. Then, Roan Loren had used his life mark to save hundreds who would have died. Today, however, there was no saving them. "Is any of this world worth fighting for?" he thought, hating the defeatist nature of his own mind. They finally had peace, and yet there were still those who were not satisfied. So long as there were differences of opinion, there would be violence and unrest. That was reality. That was the harsh truth of a world he loved most of the time. Not now. Now he hated it. Now he wanted to curl up in his bed with a book and hide from it in someone else's story. Now he wanted... Shanti collided with him so hard he dropped his blade, nearly impaling his own foot. Her arms wrapped around him, and she squeezed to the point where he found it hard to breathe. Not that he cared. Not that he would ever care if he breathed again, so long as Shanti was in his arms. And then, as swiftly as she had arrived, she pulled away, striding off in the direction of the palace gates. Most likely, he suspected, she was going to check on her students, a faithful teacher to the end. Later that night, Falcon found he couldn't escape into the pages of a book like he'd hoped. He kept reliving the horrifying scenes of the rebel attack. And though he knew it was selfish, he kept reliving the warmth of Shanti's body pressed against his as she hugged him. Every half an hour he would check her cave, but she had yet to return. His stomach grumbled, but doing something as mundane as preparing supper felt inappropriate under the circumstances. He wouldn't die from missing a meal. Those who'd already perished on this day would never get to eat again. A form appeared at the entrance to his cave, and his heart skipped a beat. "Shanti," he said, her name sounding like a prayer on his lips. She didn't move, just stood there, watching him.
I'm sorry, she said.
Falcon tried to understand her words. What could she possibly be apologizing for? Before he could respond, however, she continued,
"Have I ever told you that?"
I don't know.
He rose to his feet, the stone ground cool against his heels. He felt strange, like his body wasn't his own.
"I should have. Many times. I wanted to. I needed to. But apologizing to you felt cheap, as if a word could make up for my many sins."
"Shanti, you don't know," she interrupted.
"You don't get to excuse my mistakes. Not any more. They are mine to bear, and only I get to decide when my penance is done."
"That's not what I was going to say," Falcon said. "You already know how I feel about the past. There's no need to repeat myself."
Shanti finally stepped forward into the lantern light. Falcon's breath caught.
"Gods, she's beautiful." He wanted to run to her, to touch her, to make certain she was real.
It took all his effort to anchor himself in place.
I won't ruin what we have. That hug was nothing, just a gut reaction to a near-death experience. We cannot touch ever again. Not like that.
What were you going to say? Shanti asked.
Falcon's head swam. He couldn't remember.
Oh, yes. I was going to say that I should apologize, too.
For what?
He took a step forward, the distance between them, oddly, seeming to widen.
For making all this so hard on you. I should never have tried to get you to replace Jai with me. It wasn't fair.
To his surprise, she laughed. It wasn't a mocking sound, more like an incredulous one.
You think this is about Jai?
He frowned.
Isn't it?
Yes.
You loved him. He was your soulmate. He was what I can never be.
Oh, gods, Falcon, I'm so sorry. I thought you understood. This was never about Jai. At first, maybe, but not for the last several years. It's true. Time heals most things. Jai's loss still hurts, but it's like an old scar now. My own failings hurt more. This has always been about me. That's how selfish I am. That's why I could never be worthy of you.
What?
Falcon couldn't feel his feet, and yet he managed another step forward.
Jai was a great man, but so are you. You are the two greatest men I have ever known. My heart may be small, but there is room for you both.
Falcon wondered whether he'd fallen asleep, his love for Shanti spilling into his dreams.
No, he thought. This is real. It has to be. It has to.
Shanti continued speaking, moving closer.
A part of me may always be broken, but that doesn't mean I can't live. I hate that it took what happened today to help me learn that, but the world is unpredictable.
What is she saying?
I'm finally ready.
For what?
Falcon's voice sounded small to his own ears.
For you.
Shanti had reached him now, her fingers grasping his hand, sending a tingling sensation through the whole of his body. She dropped to her knees.
What are you— Don't be a fool, Falcon Hoser. I'm proposing to you.
Epilogue 3. Nura Loren Aris. The Western Kingdom, Night's End. Circa 548. Under the light of twin full moons, Nura Loren Aris kissed Stanley Winchester. He was a roguish sort, dark-eyed and handsome, with a firm chest and arms on account of carrying barrels of fine wine throughout the palace at Night's End. Here, in the quiet shadows of the cryptlands, it was everything Nura thought a first kiss would be. Heart-pounding and breathtaking, clumsy hands and urgent lips, and she froze, clutching at her own head, which was suddenly full of buzzing, as if home to a swarm of bees. Stanley, oblivious to her discomfort, went right on kissing, his lips working the way to her chin, her neck.
"Please," she said.
"Stop."
If he heard her, the eager boy gave no indication. The buzzing intensified, as it always did, and Nura knew somewhere in the Four Kingdoms there was the great suffering that came before, during, and after violence. The pain of injury, the finality of death, the sorrow of the survivors. She had the sudden urge to run, to find those in pain, to help them in any way she could, whether that involved her peace mark or not. Stanley was still kissing, his hands trying to find their way beneath her dress. Though she abhorred violence, her mother hadn't raised her to be weak.
"Stop!"
she said, louder this time. When he continued to ignore her, she shoved him, swinging her arm about and elbowing him in the lip. He stared at her, aghast.
"I said stop," she breathed.
Her uncle Roan, if he still lived, would have been as shocked as Stanley.
"Some peacemaker I am," she thought,
"drawing first blood." Then again, she was only peace-marked. It was Uncle Roan who had been the peacemaker. A subtle distinction, but an important one.
"You're as mad as your mother," the boy said,
reaching up to touch his bottom lip, which was bleeding.
"My mother is the greatest woman I have ever known," Nora said, momentarily distracted from that buzzing in her head. "Thus, I shall take that as a compliment."
Stanley shook his head.
"A lesser man would leave you alone in the Cryptlands, but I will wait without the wall to escort you back to the castle."
"No need," Nora said. "My man has been watching the entire time. Just now he has an arrow pointed at your heart. You expect me to believe—"
Somewhere atop the wall surrounding the Loren crypt, a bowstring sang, though it wasn't heard until the arrow had zipped past, plunking into the tree under which they'd been kissing.
"Holy gods of the south," Stanley hissed. "I might have been killed." "Don't be so dramatic. Sir Corey is an excellent shot. If he'd wanted to kill you, you'd be dead."
"Madness," Stanley said, rising to his feet and stumbling away, tripping once on a root before righting himself and exiting through the main door.
Nora sighed.
"Was that really necessary, sir?" she said, peering up at the wall,
where a form stood erect, bow gripped loosely in one hand. Her parents had always been honest with her, and thus they had earned her own trust and respect.
"No sneaking about," her mother had counselled. "Don't turn out like me. We won't stop you from making bad choices, but we will protect you. Sir Corey shall accompany you wherever you go, a silent observer. He won't intrude unless requested, or he feels you are in danger."
"Nay, but I'm entitled to a bit of fun now and again, aren't I?" the knight said. "And he might have deserved it a little."
Nora couldn't deny that fact, though on another night she mightn't have been so swift to reject the young man's advances. He was handsome, after all.
"But the buzzing," she thought,
once more feeling the bite of thousands of tiny bee stings in her head.
"My lady," Sir Corey said,
already climbing down a narrow stone staircase to the ground.
"Are you ill?"
"No, thank you. I'm just tired."
"We should be getting back."
"I know, but can I request a short while longer? I want to pay my respects to my ancestors."
She felt slightly bad, playing such a sacrilegious card, but she couldn't imagine trying to walk home feeling like this. She knew the knight would carry her if needed, but her mother had not raised her as the type of woman to be carried when in distress.
"Of course. I shall wait without the door. Shout if you need me."
"Thank you, sir. But I shall be fine."
The moment the knight was gone, she pressed her thumbs into her temples, concentrating. She felt her skin grow hot, and then images began flashing through her mind. Fanes, the great canyon city. A tournament of some sort.
No. No!
The violence arrived with such speed and brutality she could feel every sword slash, every life laid to waste. It was the antithesis to everything she held sacred. And then it was over. She released a deep breath, her heart slowing, her skin cooling until she was shivering in the dark. She hugged herself and leaned back into the ancient tree that was meant to symbolize the strength of all the Loren souls who had travelled from this life into the seventh heaven. Nora had read about such beliefs in the history books. She knew of the deity Wrath and its minions, the Furia, though the sisterhood had been abolished shortly after she was born. According to her parents, those devout women had been misguided in their faith, believing in the lording of violence as a way of forcing righteousness. Still, Nora liked to believe her ancestors were in another place, looking down upon her. From the stars, perhaps, like the southerners believed. Already, she was feeling more at peace. Perhaps it was knowing the unrest in Fanes had been temporarily quelled, or perhaps it was this resting place of the dead. The stars shone brightly, an ocean of reds and golds and greens. Her father had taught her all about the stars. He'd once been a sailor. At least, that was the term he used, though Nora had heard the rumours of another more appropriate title.
Pirate, she thought.
She smiled at the thought. Her father, a pirate? Impossible. He was the gentlest, most doting man she'd ever met. Not some swashbuckling scoundrel fighting and thieving his way across the burning sea. She raised her hand, using a finger to trace the constellations she knew so well. Her uncle, the peacemaker, with his long flowing hair. He was on his knees, hands raised to the sky, calling upon his life mark to save lives at the end of the battle known as the fall of all things. It had been his last and greatest act, when she was but a babe in her mother's arms. The lost sun lay nearby, a cluster of stars forming the three drops of blood on his chest. The pain mark, Nora thought. The great villain of this century, his hoard the subject of many a book, some reading almost as fiction, though every word was supposedly true. Nora still didn't quite understand her own role in the battle, though her parents had told her the story many times. Her marking had somehow lit up the night sky, driving away Clar Grah's pain-filled mist. Apparently that had helped turn the tide of evil, giving them a chance to emerge victorious. But how? She wondered now. How, as an infant, had she managed such a thing? And why now did she feel so helpless each time she felt the pull of violence and unrest, a silent observer to the misfortunes of a world that had been so kind to her? Why can't I do anything to help? She sighed, finally rising to her feet. She really shouldn't linger much longer, else her father lose his mind with worry. He might have allowed her certain freedoms, but that didn't change who he was. Nora glanced once more at the battle in the sky, before heading for home. Nora had just finished telling her parents about the vision of Fane's she'd had the night before, when a knock sounded.
"Enter," her mother said.
She was garbed in a flowing red dress that accentuated her pregnant belly, as ripe as a rock melon. Nora was excited to be a big sister, something she'd coveted for many long years. The messenger opened the door, his eyes flitting worriedly between all three of them, before settling on Rael Aren.
"A stream arrived from Fane's. The king has requested your presence."
Nora's mother didn't ask what information the message contained, because she already knew. The uprising. The odd thing was, Nora had woken up with bees in her head this morning. Not as powerful as the night before, but still there. An ever-present drone between her ears. She'd focused, trying to see the violent images that usually came with the bees, but she'd seen nothing.
"What does it mean?" she wondered.
When no one said anything, Nora's father said,
"Thank you. You may go."
The messenger didn't move.
"I'm supposed to escort you."
"Are you now?"
Rhea said, firing arrows from her eyes at the poor man. Nora felt somewhat bad for him, caught between a king and a woman who'd once been a queen.
Talk about a rock and a hard place.
As usual, it was Nora's father who brought balance to his fiery wife. He placed a gentle hand on her knee and said,
"We will come."
Rhea refocused her ire on Grey, but he merely smiled in response.
"It was you who relinquished the throne to him, was it not?" "A decision I regret every day," Rhea said, which almost made Nora laugh.
She knew her mother well enough to recognize the white lie. The messenger, however, seemed to take it at face value, blanching at the treasonous statement. In truth, Nora knew, her mother thought her cousin Ennis was a great king. Of course they did butt heads from time to time. But such a thing was inevitable when two rams tried to pass each other on a narrow road.
"Come, daughter, wife,"
Grey said, always diplomatic. He stood and extended his hands to both sides.
"The king beckons."
Nora stood immediately, taking his hand. She was her father's little princess, a position she didn't begrudge just because she was now a woman grown. Her mother, on the other hand, took her precious time, pretending to groan and struggle as she arose, refusing to take her husband's hand, instead settling both her palms on her belly. Grey chuckled and led Nora from the room. King Ennis filled the throne well, his arms settling onto each armrest, his back straight and broad. Despite being somewhat older than Rhea's parents, he had aged well, his silver-grey hair quite striking as it framed his knightly face. Nora bowed and took up the correct position to the left. Across the way, her cousin grinned at her. Ennis had several children, but Harriet was the closest to Nora's age, and they'd been fast friends since before they could walk. She was a pretty, fashionable girl, and Nora always appreciated her sense of style. Today she wore an aqua velvet dress that fell just above her knees, displaying so much skin Nora was certain several generations of Lorenz were rolling over in the crypt. The sleeves and neck were modest, however.
"Only give the boys a taste to keep them coming back," Harriet always said.
Of course, she rarely stuck with the same boy for more than a few days. Nora managed to grin back, though the buzzing in her head was picking up again, causing her some discomfort. Her cousin's smile faded, and she mouthed, "Are you all right?" "She knows me too well," Nora thought, managing a slight nod that did little to erase Harriet's frown. Her cousin knew all about the buzzing bees and her visions. Few others, save Nora's parents, were aware of the same. King Ennis was one, as was his wife, Queen Bernadette, a stately woman who was one of the few people who could handle Nora's mother. She stood beside the king, her own hair piled in a nest atop her head, her tall, slender form clothed in a regal grey dress appropriate for a queen. Rhea made a show of taking a plush seat that had been especially prepared for her. Grey rolled his eyes and exchanged a knowing glance with the king. Nora, however, barely noticed, her head beginning to ache from the bees. "Something bad is happening again," she thought. "But what? And where?" The king whispered to his wife, who said, "The uprisings in the south are growing bolder." In addition to being Ennis's wife and counsellor, the queen was also his mouthpiece, due to his severed nub of a tongue, which had been taken by Clara Grah 16 years hence. "We know," Rhea said. Nora's mother had a tendency to thrive on information. Control. "Nora has been feeling it almost every day." "Last night was the worst," Nora blurted out, because she had to say something to release the tension in her head. It didn't help, and she cringed. Ennis frowned, whispering more to the queen. "Another attack today?" she asked. "I don't know," Nora admitted. "I haven't seen anything, but it hurts." "Oh, sweetness," her father said, roping an arm around her. "You should have told us." "It's only gotten worse just now," she said. "You should lie down," Rhea said. "I will send the healers with a potion, something to help you sleep." "I'm all right," Nora said. The last thing she wanted was to be reduced to a foggy stupor. That was worse than the pain. After consulting with the king, the queen said, "This is most disturbing information. The stream we received today was fairly specific that we not send aid. The Phoenicians seem to have the situation under control." "Obviously not," Rhea said harshly, gesturing to Nora. "My daughter is not a complainer. If she is in distress, things are about to get much worse for our neighbours to the south."
"What if it's not the south?" Grey said, squeezing Nora's arm.
"Are you certain?" he asked her, his eyes full of compassion. I don't know. All of my visions this year have been of Fanes." "See?" Rhea said, as if some irrefutable conclusion had been arrived at. "If we don't act now, the peace we've enjoyed for almost 2 decades will be at risk." Just then the pain intensified, and Nora cried out, dropping to her knees. Her father joined her a moment later, cradling her head against his chest. His hand smoothed her hair, drawing it away from her face. Just as swiftly as it had arrived, the pain vanished.
"Let's go for a walk," Nora said, beginning to pace across the room.
Harriet frowned, her hand hovering over the parchment she'd been sketching on.
"You must rest, Nora." "I'm fine," she insisted. "Completely. I don't feel anything. Well, except bored." "Read one of those history books you're so fond of," her cousin suggested, her hand once more moving across the page.
Harriet was a talented artist, particularly when it came to faces. Nora considered her suggestion, but just as quickly discarded it. Getting lost in the pages of a book didn't interest her right now.
"Please." "Fine," Harriet huffed,
making it sound like the notion was the greatest inconvenience in the world.
"But let me finish my sketch. It's almost done."
Nora flopped down onto her soft bed, inspecting the stone ceiling. She closed her eyes, willing herself to see something, anything. Not knowing what her earlier pain had been caused by was somehow worse than knowing.
"The fear of the unknown," she thought. "I am more like my mother than I like to think. I have the same need for control as she does."
It was true. Nora was used to knowing everything. Because of her peace mark and the knowledge it provided, she was brought in on other matters, too. She knew what was happening in all corners of the Four Kingdoms.
For example, the North had finally managed to rebuild Blackstone, and the Northerners were in the process of constructing ships for a voyage of exploration to Crimea. To the east, King Gareth Ironclad had recently celebrated his name day. Nora's mother had received an invitation to the party, but in her current state she'd declined, muttering something about the entire affair being nothing but an excuse to eat and drink and carry on like a merry band of fools. Nora had detected the disappointment in her mother's voice. Calypso, on the other hand, was relatively closed off from the other nations. The Southerners preferred the isolation their geographical location provided. Tucked across two large bodies of water, Dragon Bay and the Burning Sea, and behind the vast Skara Desert, the Southern nation might have been on the other side of the world. Still, there was a market for their spiced snake meat, fine silk scarves, and rare dragon fang jewellery. Empress Whisper Sands, however, had refused to even discuss the notion of trade. Once a year she sent a stream reiterating her position and denying further discussion. Nora was happy so long as peace was maintained. Thus far, it was only Fanes that were struggling in that regard, which was why she was almost certain the unrest had caused her earlier episode. Perhaps it was an aftershock from last night, she thought, though something about the idea didn't ring true. Finished, Harriet crowed. What do you think? Nora sat up, looking over at where her cousin held the parchment up. You weasel, Nora squealed, shoving to her feet and racing across the room to try to snatch the sketch from her cousin's grasp. What? Did I get something wrong? Harriet said. There was a hint of amusement in her voice as she shielded the drawing with her body. Nora snatched at it again, but came up empty, her cousin holding it just out of reach, where she could still see it. In fact, the sketch was remarkably accurate, almost as if her cousin had been there spying on her. From the angle of Stanley's body tucked against hers, to his hand on her hip, to their lips locked in her first ever kiss, the drawing was utterly perfect. The kicker was the shadowy figure atop the wall, Sir Corey's arrow aimed at them. Why do I tell her everything? Nora wondered. I'm going to frame it, I think, Harriet said, her threat transitioning into a peal of laughter when Nora resorted to a dirty trick, tickling her. The distraction was just enough for Nora to slip past her cousin's defences and wrench the paper away. I shall consider it a gift, she said, to do with as I please. I think I will shred it into 1,000 pieces. You wouldn't, Harriet said. I spent half the afternoon on it. Or maybe I'll burn it, Nora said, tapping her teeth as if in deep consideration. Yes, it would make for perfect kindling. You're a witch, Harriet said, but she was laughing. I bet as soon as I go you'll tuck it under your pillow so you can gaze upon it each night before you sleep. No, wait. You'll kiss it the same way you kissed that gorgeous Stanley boy, until it's covered with pink lipshade. And then you'll elbow it and ask Sir Corey to shoot it with an arrow. Nora's eyes widened, and she knew there was only one thing left to do. She kissed the drawing, moving hither and thither as though she was going to devour it. And her cousin laughed and laughed and laughed. Their walk was pleasant enough, though Nora's enjoyment was tempered by the pain in her head which had returned. She pretended it was nothing, but her cousin wasn't fooled. "We need to get you back to bed," Harriet said, reaching out to hold her by the elbow. She started to steer her out of the crowded marketplace. "No," Nora protested, wrenching her arm from her cousin's grip. Harriet stared at her, shocked. "Sorry, I'm just trying to help." The castle guards that had been sent to watch over the two girls looked uncertain how to handle the situation.
I know, Nora said, crestfallen.
It hadn't been her intention to offend her cousin, who meant well. It was just...
What was it? There's something I have to do.
She frowned, wondering where the words had come from. What exactly did she have to do?
Like buy a new dress? Harriet asked. No, nothing like that, Nora said, feeling unsure of herself. It was something important, wasn't it?
She grimaced, a shockwave erupting in her skull. It took all her strength and control to remain on her feet.
Please, cousin, Harriet said. This is madness,
Nora suggested, remembering Stanley's choice of words from the night before. Perhaps it was. Or perhaps it was something else entirely.
No, you know I didn't mean it that way.
Harriet placed a hand softly on her shoulder.
Come, let's get back and see what the chef has whipped up for supper tonight.
Another pang of agony shot through Nora's head, but she was growing used to it now. This time her rebuke was softer, which seemed to have an even greater effect.
No, thank you, dear cousin. I shall catch up with you later. Take half of the guards and return to the castle. We shall sup together on another evening.
Harriet sighed, but didn't argue this time.
As you wish. See you tomorrow for tutoring?
Of course. Nora barely managed to hide the strain in her voice. The pain was her constant companion now.
Goodbye.
When Harriet was gone with her retinue of guardsmen in tow, Sir Corey strode forward and said,
"Shall we continue exploring Corazon's Corner?"
"No," she said. "I'd like to explore the southern part of the city." "Do I really?"
"At the risk of sounding insolent, might I inquire as to why, my lady? There is nothing much there."
How could she explain that even she didn't know the answer to his question?
"I don't have to explain anything," she reminded herself. "I've never seen it. I think I would enjoy studying the architecture."
Sir Corey's facial expression didn't really change, though she could tell from the slight crinkling at the corners of his eyes that her response did little to quell his unease.
"As you wish, my lady. Men, remain vigilant."
Something had stopped her in front of the decrepit old building. Its outer wall was full of cracks, and the pillars at the top of the small staircase were half crumbling, a portion of the overhang having broken off and shattered on the ground. The entire structure was painted red, though the colour had faded long ago, appearing pink rather than the scarlet hue that had once represented a mixture of fear and devoutness to a deity that had ruled this very city.
"The Furium," she thought.
The nondescript building was once a training ground for Roth's all-female holy warriors.
"My lady," Sir Corey said, "we should not linger near this haunted place."
"Haunted?" she said.
Nora had heard all the stories about how the Furia, led by the three Furies, had made their last stand here, holding off the Horde for nearly half a day before relenting under the savage onslaught. They'd all been killed. Mature women, young girls, everything in between. The fiercest fellowship of women in the West was ended. Her cousin Ennis's first decree after becoming king was to abolish the Furia before it could be re-established.
"Superstitions, nothing more."
"Aye, but that doesn't mean I want to put such superstitions to the test."
Nora couldn't tell whether the loyal knight was being serious or not. Either way, she felt drawn to this place. She took a step forward, stopping suddenly, and dropping to one knee when a fresh wave of pain rolled through her.
"My lady,"
Sir Corey said, crouching beside her. He barked an order to his men, but Nora didn't catch the details because she could hear something else. Words. A whispery chant, spoken in unison by a multitude of lips.
"We have no hearts, no minds, no souls, for they are not ours, not any more. O Roth, we give them to you. We raise our voices as one, and we know you shall not waste us. For when we live for you, and when we die for you. Your once righteous kingdom shall be restored because of our faith. No, the ways of old are no longer relevant. A new path is set before our feet. Your righteous order cannot be separated from the throne any longer. We are your red warriors, and we will reclaim what is yours."
Nora was dimly aware that Sir Corey was speaking to her, though his voice seemed to come from a faraway place, echoing through a dark, dark cave, and then,
"My lady?"
She stared up at him, his face framed by a clear sky that was swiftly collapsing under the heavy shadows of dusk.
"I'm fine, sir," she said. "Just a sudden headache. Nothing more."
Sir Corey didn't look convinced.
"I will carry you back. Some soup and pine nettle tea will help. You'll be right as rain by the morning."
Nora wished she could do as this man asked. But this was no longer just about her.
She didn't know where those voices had come from, ghosts from the past, her own imagination. But she also knew she wasn't leaving until she'd explored this place.
"I'm going inside," she said.
"My lady."
She wasn't certain how to proceed if the knight denied her.
"Please, I want to go inside. Just for a minute or two. For my studies."
Sir Corey closed his eyes, opened them.
"Just a minute or two?"
She nodded, managing a smile.
"Fine, but no longer. The day has wings, and I'd rather not escort you home in the dark. Your mother will have my head."
He chuckled nervously, though Nora knew it was no joke. She'd seen her mother's anger too many times.
"Thank you."
Nora started toward the cracked and broken steps that led up to the entrance, accepting Sikori's help onto the patio. Dusty stone rubble blocked the way forward, but Nora scrabbled over it, using her hands to steady herself.
"Wait for your guards," the knight said.
But Nora was already past the debris and hurrying through the main doors. Just inside was an atrium of sorts. The floor was littered with more rubble and debris. An enormous painting had either fallen or been pulled from the wall, its frame cracked in three places. All around it, jewels glittered. Emeralds, rubies.
"Is that a diamond? Are those real?"
Nora wondered. If they were, it was a wonder this place hadn't been looted after all these long years. The fear of this place was strong. Toward the other end of the room, a barrel had been upended, its wooden slats cracked and splintered. The floor was coated in a thick pool of red, long dried.
"Is that blood?"
Nora wondered. She immediately chided herself for being so foolish. 16-year-old dried blood wouldn't be so red anymore.
"Dye," she thought,
remembering how each initiate that entered the Furium would colour her hair red in a show of uniformity.
"They cast off their own identities to become closer to Roth."
"My lady," Sir Corey said from behind her. "Have you seen enough?"
"Not yet," she said,
slipping through a door hanging from one hinge.
"Forward,"
the knight ordered in her wake. Inside, the Furium was open to the air in the form of a large square courtyard. Around the edges was a covered stone walkway lined with pillars, though many had been destroyed. The courtyard itself was empty, or at least it had been a moment ago. Now her guardsmen spread out across the area, swords drawn, wary eyes watching the many doorways that presumably led to where the red-clad women used to sleep and break bread.
"And here was where they were trained to be killers," Nora thought.
As she took it all in, trying to imagine young girls doing battle with various manner of weaponry, she realized something. The pain in her head was gone.
"Satisfied?" Sir Corey asked a few minutes later.
Nora had walked her full circle through the courtyard, peering into shadows and searching for what? Nora chewed her lip. Her entire body felt warm, and not from the heat of the day or the exertion of the long walk.
"My peace mark is active," she thought.
It sometimes did this when there was violence in the Four Kingdoms. Sometimes the pain accompanied the strange feeling, but not now. Had another rebellion arisen in the south? As far as she knew, the other kingdoms were stable. Only Fanes were struggling to maintain order.
Something felt off,
something she couldn't quite put her finger on. Something about the many doors that lined the stone walkway. She frowned, puzzling her way through some mystery.
"Everything here is old and dusty, unused. But those doors, they look new. Why would that—"
She never finished her question, for each and every door ringing the courtyard burst open. Red and silver flashed all around as girls and women alike leapt over the debris, their crimson dresses swirling about their feet as they brought steel to bear.
"The chanting," Nora thought. "It wasn't my imagination at all. I was hearing these women."
Sir Corey's men, though likely surprised by the sudden attack, were not idle. They closed their ranks around her, their blades at the ready, obeying the knight's orders as he shouted to them over the sound of their enemy's footsteps.
"Are these women our enemy?" Nora thought,
wondering why she had come to that conclusion so swiftly. Once upon a time, the Furia had protected Knight's End. It was against the law for them to re-establish themselves, but that didn't mean they were wicked, right? Nora wanted to cling to that belief, but it was as weak as a pine cone hanging from a branch in the midst of a hurricane.
Their chant. They want to overthrow Cousin Ennis. A coup. Everything made sense now.
The pain she'd been experiencing over the last day or so, more powerful than any she'd felt so far. Her need to explore this place, her sense of unease. The impending violence planned by these women had caused her peace mark to flare up. And now there was nothing she could do about it. Elbowing Stanley was one thing. Fighting an ancient order of highly trained women warriors was a whole other animal. The first ring of steel against steel was shockingly loud, resonating through her as if the blow had been struck directly beside her ears. The pain swarmed through her once more, and she staggered. Sir Corey caught her before she fell, his eyes wide with concern. A man screamed in pain, one of the furious swords slipping past his defences.
"We have to get you out of here,"
the knight said, his eyes darting about as he tried to locate a path to safety.
"There,"
he said, motioning with his head, where several guardsmen had managed to cut down three warriors in short succession. For the moment, the way was clear. Her head was pounding. The violence all around her struck like lightning bolts with each jab, each slash, each death. Blood was being spilled, and Nora could feel each drop, like acid burning into her skin. She cried out. All she wanted to do was escape this horrible place. All she wanted to do was erase this day, to wish it away, to run far, far away. Sir Corey scooped her up in his arms and ran, shoving his way past one of his own men as he did battle with one of the Furia, his body jerking as her steel entered his chest and exited through his back, the blade as red as the woman who wielded it. Nora's head felt ready to explode, the pressure almost too much for her to take. Her only option was escape, wasn't it? She didn't belong here. She bore the mark of peace, not war, not battle, just like... Oh. Oh. The clarity came on with such speed it took her breath away. The pain receded into the background, as distant as the call of an eagle high in the sky. Her own uncle, Roan, he who was life-marked and known as the peacemaker, had never killed. And yet when the battle against the Horde was at its fiercest, he ran not away, but toward it. She kicked out sharply, throwing Sir Corey off balance. He lost his grip on her, and she fell, tumbling hard to the ground, ignoring a flash of pain in her knee because it was nothing compared to what she'd already felt. He reached for her, but she rolled away, and then she stood. Her peace mark burned through her, and its power was no longer an enigma, at least not completely. She felt it thrumming through her blood, through her bones. It was a part of her. It was her. And I am it. Stop! She shouted, her voice as loud as a thunderclap. They stopped, all of them. Nora turned slowly in a full circle, because it wasn't the strength of her voice that had ceased their movement, their violence. It was the power of her mark, for they weren't just stopped, but frozen. Some were on the verge of ending each other. Others were trapped in mid-leap, defying gravity as they hung in the air. Others were tumbling to the ground, drops of blood waiting patiently to fall. Nora reached out and touched one such drop, the red liquid rolling down her finger.
"What have I done?" she thought,
wondering whether she'd stopped the entire world forever, like it was a great clock and she had removed all the gears and springs. What if, in the name of peace, she would be forced to live out the rest of her days in a world like this?
Stop, she thought,
trying to use her own power to calm the fraying threads of her mind.
You caused this. You can uncause it.
But first, there was something she needed to do. It took the better part of an hour to complete her work. By the time she finished, it should have been night. But it seemed she'd managed to stop even the cycle of the sun and moon from moving forward, the sky smeared with lines of pink and purple. She inspected the courtyard for a few moments, checking and rechecking that she'd been thorough enough in her preparations.
To restart time, she thought, satisfied,
feeling for that well of power running through her. And then she took a sip. No bodies fell, for none were off balance or halfway to the ground. She'd placed those who were injured gently on the ground, their bandages packed and tied tight with makeshift tourniquets. Nora had removed all the weapons from the hands that gripped them, making a pile in one corner of the yard, well away from the action. The women warriors had been bound tightly using ropes Rhea had located inside one of the nearby rooms. Now the Furious squirmed and cursed, fighting against the tethers. The guardsmen looked around, confused, trying to understand how the battle had been won. To them it would have taken no more than a blink of their eyes. The injured groaned and grimaced, but most, if not all, would likely survive. If Nora hadn't watched herself do it, she would scarcely be able to believe it either.
"So this is my purpose," she thought.
She didn't feel smug or heroic, for it was not she who had accomplished such a great act. Well, not entirely. Her peace mark had allowed her to do it. But she did feel warm inside, happy. The pain in her head was gone, and Ennis was safe on the throne. Sir Corey was staring at her.
"My lady?"
"Now we can go home, sir. Thank you for protecting me."
Nora finished her story, and Harriet clapped.
"If Sir Corey and a dozen of his guardsmen hadn't been there to witness it, I would swear it was fiction," she said.
"So would I,"
Nora admitted. King Ennis's eyes sparkled with unshed tears, and it made Nora tear up as well. Not only because of the love she had for him, but for never having the chance to love her Uncle Roan, who, Nora now realized, she probably had a lot in common with.
"Roan would have been proud of you," her mother said. "How does she do that?" Nora wondered. "How does she read my mind?"
But that didn't matter, because her mother's words made her smile as several happy tears leaked from her eyes.
"And you?"
she managed to ask.
"I probably would have killed them all,"
Rhea Loren said, smirking.
"But your way worked just as well. I'm proud of you too, my daughter. Thank you, Mother."
Epilogue 4. Bear Black Boots. Crimea, Rockland. Circa 599. Turning his back on the fall of all things had been the hardest thing Bear Blackboots had ever had to do. Even all these long years later, that day haunted him. It hadn't been fear or lack of courage that had turned him away, but something his mother had told him before she died, something that hadn't made sense at the time, but which he deciphered over months and years of pondering.
"At the penultimate moment, son, you cannot intervene. For such is not our role to play, and doing so could mean the undoing of all we've worked for. Promise me you will turn away. Promise me."
Back then, he'd been just a boy, as malleable as clay. He would have promised his mother the moons and stars if she'd asked him, and figured out how to capture them later. Fleeing from the battle for the Four Kingdoms had been even harder than that. Every step had brought fat tears rolling down his cheeks, wetting his fur. Eventually the fur was gone, his claws returning to fingernails, his fangs to teeth. Naked, he'd curled up in a ball and wept. When he was certain the battle was over, either for good or ill, he'd considered returning to the killing fields. This time he had acted out of cowardice, for he didn't want to see what had transpired, and he feared what he might do if the Horde had prevailed. So, again, he'd fled. At first he'd travelled further south, using rarely travelled roads known to few. He'd skirted the edge of the Red Cliffs, taking risks with each footfall. Twice he'd stopped and gazed longingly at the waves crashing along the shoreline.
"If I jump, will I die? Or will my mother's magic save me from even that? Can I even die?"
In the end, he hadn't wanted to find out, for it was only the eventual hope for death that drove him. And yet death had continued to elude him, the years passing like hours, the decades like days. He'd been on this earth for more than two centuries, even longer than most Orions.
"Why?" he'd thought as he'd travelled through Tarragon. "Why am I still alive?"
The once barren lands south of the Burning Sea were coming to life once more. Ships were arriving monthly from Fanes, some filled with people, the Terrans, returning home, and others heavy laden with goods for trade. They returned to Fanes with the same, people and goods. When Bear had seen that first ship,
He'd fallen to his knees and thanked every god he knew that he hadn't cost them the battle against the Horde. As usual, his mother had been right.
She's gone,